I next met with Dr. Mario Schnoll, and to continue the discussion about the new immunotherapy of cancer, he reviewed the key pathways currently being targeted with checkpoint inhibitors.
Think about it this way. The body recognizes foreign antigens. T lymphocytes really are the key cells here. And T cells have this broad array of T cell receptors, right? There's many. That's how you recognize foreign antigens. And what they're actually recognizing are peptides sitting on MHC molecules on the surface of cells. So what that really means is that proteins are processed inside the cell to small fragments, and they're put on the surface of the cell. And that's really what the immune system is recognizing, what lymphocytes are recognizing. And the reason why we're able to fight off all these pathogens and viruses is that we have this immense capacity to produce a large number of T cell receptors by recombination of different genes inside the cells. And these T cell receptors then recognize these peptide fragments of proteins that are sitting on the surface of a cell. So think of the lymphocyte as sampling intracellular proteins. Now, lymphocytes that recognize self-antigen either are tolerized or deleted, right? Otherwise, you would be attacking your normal tissues. But when you develop mutations in your tumor, which now are different than normal self, or you start expressing proteins that were never expressed since development, so you probably haven't developed tolerance or deleted those T cells, those antigens can now be recognized by the immune system. Those lymphocytes can now recognize these quote-unquote foreign antigens. They're foreign because they're mutations, they're not self, or they haven't been expressed in the adult. So the next question is what happens in the context of a developing immune response? So think about it. When you have a virus, your immune system has to turn on and then turn off. If it turns on and doesn't turn off, you have all these cytokines, you get sick, you get fever, you get hypotension, you go into the ICU as if you had sepsis. So there are many controls on the immune system so that lymphocytes expand and then contract and then disappear based on the necessity of the immune response at that point in time. And there's a very sophisticated control of this lymphocyte response, this T cell response. And it involves on and off signals on the lymphocyte that are transmitted by whatever cell it's recognizing, either an antigen-presenting cell, the body's professional antigen-presenting cells, or by the tumor cells. So think of the lymphocyte as having on and off switches, both on and off switches. So you have a switch for on and a switch for off. Now, in the context of a cancer that has mutations or these antigens that are recognized by the immune system, almost certainly over the course of the lifetime of that cancer being in the body, those antigens are presented to the immune system. But in the context of that, the expansion of the immune system is limited by these off switches, these checkpoints. There has to be some control. And also, even if you get the lymphocytes into the tumor has found a way to co-opt these mechanisms to also flick those off switches on the lymphocytes. Those are the checkpoints. So what we believe is happening in many patients is not that you're generating a new immune response against your cancer, it's that your immune response has been blunted to some degree by these checkpoints, by the tumor or the body flicking these off switches on these lymphocytes, which should be on and should continue to stay on. And the whole concept of a checkpoint inhibitor is blocking the flicking of these off switches on the lymphocytes so they stay on. The other analogy that people use is sort of the brake and accelerator analogy in a car. This is used a lot by Dr. Wolchuk and Dr. Hody, other people. So think of the immune system as having your foot on the accelerator and your foot on the brake at the same time. At least that's the case with an immune response against cancer. There's an immune response, it's recognizing antigens. It's on, but it's also the foot on the brake. And the context is you can activate the immune response in one of two ways. You can either put your foot on the accelerator a little bit more. That's giving cytokines or vaccines. But the problem is the foot is still on the brake. So in order to get the vaccines and the cytokines to work, you have to take your foot off the brake. And that's anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4.
So where does anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1, and anti-CTLA-4 antibodies fit into the model you just described?
Well, it's going to be 1,000 times more complicated than even my explanation because it is very complicated. But think of CTLA-4 as being something that is brought to the surface of a T cell when it's initially activated in the lymph node. Okay, so T cells, remember, T cells start in a naive state, and they're activated in the lymph node. And then eventually they differentiate and become effector cells, and those effector cells travel to tumor. And during that whole process of activation, there are different checkpoints. So think of CTLA-4 as an earlier checkpoint that occurs in the initial activation of the T cell in the lymph node. And then you give an antibody, you block CTLA-4, and you get better expansion of T cells. And we believe that to some degree that may even be these T cells that recognize maybe lower affinity antigens, sort of antigens that might not be recognized otherwise, or you might not get much T cell expansion because they're not strong antigens. So what happens is those T cells then eventually get into the tumor microenvironment, into the tumor. Once a T cell gets activated, it also upregulates PD-1 on the surface. So when the T cell gets into the tumor, it starts making cytokines, and the cytokines induce the tumor cells themselves and other immune cells or stromal cells that are in the microenvironment to upregulate the ligand for PD-1, which is PD-L1. And it's that interaction between PD-L1 that's either on the tumor or on the stromal cells and on the lymphocytes, that interaction PD-L1 to PD-1 on the lymphocyte that turns off that lymphocyte.
What's the difference in terms of the mechanism of anti-PD-1 versus anti-PD-L1?
Well, practically, there may not be a lot of difference because you're really blocking the same pathway either at the receptor or the ligand level. However, PD-1 has two ligands. One is PD-L1, the other one is PD-L2. If you block PD-1, you block both of those ligands. So that's good. But the problem is that PD ligand 1 also has another receptor called CD80. And so when you block PD-1, you block PD-L1 and PD-L2, but you still have this negative interaction that's unblocked between PD-L1 and CD80. When you block PD-L1, you block both of the interactions with CD80 and PD-1, but you leave PD-L2 alone. And PD-L2 in some tumors, by binding to PD-1, for example, may have a role in turning off the immune response. So some people have said, well, let's combine both PD-1 and PD-L1 blockade, because then we're blocking all of the elements of this pathway. So far in the clinic, it doesn't look like there's a lot of difference in clinical activity between blocking PD-1 and PD-L1 from what we've seen so far. Of course, these are small studies, non-comparative studies, so we really don't know. But there just isn't a huge amount of difference. There's a claim that blocking PD-L1 has less toxicity for some complicated reasons, meaning that when you leave PD-L2 alone, PD-L2 turns off bad T cells that cause toxicity, but not T cells that cause anti-tumor effects. So the thought is if you block PD-L1, leaving PD-L2 alone is okay because it's only inhibiting bad T cells, not good T cells. And so overall, you might see the same level of activity, but less toxicity. So far, there's a little bit of clinical data to suggest that perhaps blocking PD-L1 results in less pneumonitis, but I don't think we have enough data to be conclusive on that.
So let's talk about how this applies specifically in melanoma and what the agents are, what they do, and where they are in terms of clinical practice. Maybe you can kind of just provide an overview of sort of how this evolved and where we are today.
The first agent that came into clinical trial was nivolumab or anti-PD-1. First phase 1 trial was published, a little bit of activity was seen, and then the second study was a multi-dose trial, so giving the drug every 2 weeks for up to 2 years. And there were 5 tumors that were eligible for that trial: melanoma, renal, non-small cell, colon, and prostate cancer. And it was a phase 1 trial. A maximum tolerated dose wasn't found because this is a very well-tolerated drug. So even up to 10 milligrams per kilogram, there wasn't a maximum tolerated dose. And really, most patients had no toxicity from the drug. I mean, there are toxicities, but it's important for people to understand these are very, very well-tolerated agents in the vast majority of patients. And the remarkable thing from that trial, after all the doses were studied and the cohorts were studied, very significant activity was observed in 3 diseases: non-small cell lung cancer, renal cancer, and melanoma. And if you look at melanoma specifically, in the 107 patients that were treated in that trial, the objective response rate was 32%. So that's a very respectable number. And in addition to that, many of these responses were very durable, and we're seeing responses in patients with bulky disease. So these are also patients who have had quite a number of prior treatments. And when they looked at the survival curve in this previously treated population, it looked very respectable, 63% survival at a year, somewhere between 45 and 48% at 2 years, and the curves were relatively flat. And these are better numbers that we're accustomed to seeing in such a large phase 2 trial in this patient population. So that was anti-PD-1. Now, another anti-PD-1 came into the clinic, and this agent is called pembrolizumab. It's really very similar to nivolumab as far as we can tell. And the data that was generated for that, one of the largest phase 1 trials ever conducted, Tony Ribas just presented data on 411 patients, and the overall response rate was in the range of around 34%. So again, very similar. In that trial, they included patients who had and had not had prior anti-CTLA-4, ipilimumab. And the response rates were not all that different between those two groups. It's about 28% in patients who had had prior ipilimumab, somewhere close to 40% in patients who had not. But again, very respectable objective response rates. And these are objective response rates, not immune-related response rates. These are true objective responses. The other interesting thing about the data is that, again, there were very durable responses. I mean, right at the last presentation, probably more than 85% of all the patients who had objective responses still had ongoing responses. And the survival, again, was also very respectable. They reported a one-year survival rate of 69%. And again, that's remarkable for this group of patients with metastatic melanoma.
Can you talk also about the time sequence of when the responses are observed?
So let me put that in context of anti-CTLA-4. For anti-CTLA-4, responses can be delayed. In fact, most of the objective responses occur after 12 weeks. And with anti-CTLA-4, in a subset of patients, you actually see disease progression before you see regression. For anti-PD-1, those unconventional responses are less common. And I think the responses occur more quickly. So most of the responses you actually see by week 8. So it can occur very rapidly. In some people, we see things shrinking within the first few days after treatment.
Yeah, I was surprised when I saw that because I kind of had this intuitive thought, maybe from some of the other data, including IPI, that it takes a while for immunotherapy to work, and here your responses are occurring very quickly.
Well, and we really saw that phenomena when we combined ipilimumab and anti-PD-1. We can talk about that later, but we saw very rapid responses in some of those patients. But it's not surprising, right? Because if you're thinking that, and we really don't know how anti-CTLA-4 worked. I told you before that I thought it worked by activating cells in the lymph node. We also have data that it's also inhibiting or maybe destroying T regulatory cells in the tumor microenvironment. And in fact, there's some thought that a lot of the action for all these agents is occurring within the tumor itself. So if you think that the lymphocytes are already there, they're sort of primed to act, but they're being inhibited by the tumor, and all of a sudden you let them go and they start to work, then you could probably see very rapid tumor regressions. And I think that's the best explanation for why we see these rapid responses.
Can you compare a little bit what we know about using anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1, ipilimumab, and the combination in terms of efficacy and side effects and tolerability? I know maybe we don't have perfect data right now, but what do we know about that?
Well, if we start with ipilimumab, the objective responses range somewhere between 5 and 15%. And the median survival is somewhere on the order of around, say, 12 months. 2-year survival is somewhere in the range of 25 to 35%. So in that range. It's also more toxic than anti-PD-1 alone. You see more immune-related adverse events. Again, these are things like colitis, rash, hepatitis, endocrinopathies, and attack on almost any immune organ. If you compare that to anti-PD-1, the objective response rates now go into the range of maybe 30%. You now are seeing 1-year survivals of north of 60% and 2-year survivals, which may be north of 40 to 45%, better than what we've seen with anti-CTLA-4 alone. And it's better tolerated. There's probably only a 5% rate of these immune-related adverse events, and only about 12 to 15% of patients get grade 3-4 adverse events. Most patients really do well. The only major toxicity is this rare, well, it's not the only major toxicity, but one of the toxicities that we're concerned about is this pneumonitis that can occur, but it's relatively rare, and now we know how to manage it, and I think now that we know to look for it, we're not going to see, maybe we won't see any really severe cases, or if we do, we'll be able to reverse it like we reverse all the autoimmune adverse events of these agents, many of the adverse events of these agents. Now, when you start looking at the combination of ipilimumab and CTLA-4, the objective response rates are a little bit better, and they're in the 40% range. It's a small study that was done. But there's a lot more unconventional responses. And when you look at the survival for this small study, the one-year survival was around 85%. Two-year survival was 79%. I mean, that's almost unheard of. But it comes at a cost of more toxicity. About 60% of patients will have grade 3-4 adverse events. They're manageable, and a lot of them are laboratory toxicities. But there's no question that the incidence of grade 3-4 toxicity goes up. One last point. If you now look at median survivals, ipilimumab alone, median survival around 12 months, anti-PD-1 or PD-L1, anti-PD-1, we don't have activity for PD-L1 yet, but anti-PD-1 median survival in the range of 16 to 24 months. When you look at the combination in that small trial, the median survival was 40 months. So if it holds up in a phase 3 trial, it'll be a remarkable advance.
So cost and regulatory issues aside, as you see the data right now, what's your take on the optimal immunotherapy of metastatic disease?
Based on the data that's available today, in most patients, based on what I've seen so far, I would use anti-PD-1 in combination with ipilimumab. But obviously, it's not going to be approved that way until a phase 3 trial is conducted. So in most patients, I would give them anti-PD-1 first, if I had it available, as a single agent. It's got the best risk-benefit ratio for any of the agents that are out there. And I would probably use ipilimumab as a second-line agent or IL-2 as a second-line agent and ultimately give all three agents if I could, because it's not clear that if you're responsive to one or not responsive to one, you won't be responsive or non-responsive to the next agent. In other words, if you give anti-PD-1 and you don't respond, you can respond to ipilimumab. And it's very possible that if you don't respond to either agent, you may respond to high-dose interleukin too.
So in a patient, let's say, who is relatively asymptomatic or asymptomatic with metastatic disease, no visceral involvement, so maybe you have a little bit of time, what's your preferred sequence? And let's say the patient has a BRAF mutation. So how do you put that all together?
Again, a really difficult question. Let's start with the BRAF question, because I think that's the most controversial. So you have a combination, dabrafenib and trametinib, that give you amazing responses in probably more than 70% of patients, very rapid responses, and the median survival is 24 months. And actually, there are some patients who have durable responses to these agents. Even in that setting, I would still use an immune therapy like anti-PD-1 first, because anti-PD-1 has an excellent risk-benefit profile, and you can see durable remissions. And so, at least in my practice, I use immune therapies first. And if immune therapies don't work, then I go to targeted agents. And that's true even in patients who have low bulk, low volume, slowly progressive disease. If they have very, very rapidly progressive disease and they have huge tumor bulk and I just don't think I can get the immune therapy in some of those patients, I might give the combination of dabrafenib and trametinib first at this point.
So in a typical situation where a doc in practice has either IPI or high-dose IL-2, and probably with a referral to consider, what do you think the best sequence of those two is?
In a world where anti-PD-1 doesn't exist,
right,
in a patient with low-volume disease, we would probably give high-dose IL-2 first and then give ipilimumab for a variety of reasons. One is IL-2 gives us a 5% rate of durable remissions. Remember, you have to select your patients very carefully for interleukin-2. They have to have normal heart, very good lungs, no autoimmune diseases, good renal and liver function. So you're really talking about a subset of patients that would get high-dose IL-2 first. In the group that can't get high-dose IL-2, you'd obviously use ipilimumab. But in the right patient, we would use IL-2 first and then ipilimumab. If you give ipilimumab first, some of these patients can develop, a very small percentage can develop, prolonged autoimmune toxicity. It takes a while for that to resolve. And then it's hard to get them to interleukin-2. And some of these people have residual colitis. And if you give them IL-2 after that, you can make them very sick. So it's better to go in the direction of IL-2 first and then ipilimumab in the right patient.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience in terms of side effects and toxicity, particularly with IPI, since that's the one that's out there right now? And maybe in seeing patients that have been managed by other docs, some, I'm not going to say myths or misperceptions, but maybe some pearls about looking for toxicity and managing it?
Ipilimumab at 3 milligrams per kilogram is actually very well tolerated in most patients. About 15% of patients will have grade 3-4 adverse events. And you can manage those patients very easily with steroids. It's really important to catch it early and to give the steroids at the right time and even at the right dose. So the most critical thing about ipilimumab is if somebody is developing a serious immune-related adverse event, so they're getting colitis and bad colitis, you really need to give them steroids and high-dose steroids early until it resolves. And if they don't respond to the steroids, you need to come in with a second immune suppressive agent like infliximab, primarily for the colitis, by the way.
In terms of the colitis, what kind of clinical history will get you to take any kind of initial action? And maybe you can describe the spectrum of what's seen in terms of symptomatology and how you respond to it.
We actually wrote a paper. So there's something out there in, I think, community oncology that talks about this. But so for colitis, if somebody comes in and they have a little bit of diarrhea, we tend to keep in touch with them on a daily, every other day basis, just to make sure that it doesn't get worse. So it could be grade 1 or early grade 2 diarrhea. And in some of these people, it'll just resolve on its own. You don't need to do anything. But if it's grade 1 or grade 2 diarrhea that persists for more than 3 or 4 days, then we start thinking about giving them steroids. And as long as it doesn't get worse, we might just give them moderate dose steroids. Once they start to get to grade 3 toxicity, so grade 3 diarrhea, or they get low-grade diarrhea, but they have symptoms like cramps and nausea and a little bit of fever, those people we actually bring into the hospital and give them IV high-dose steroids. And we usually give them 2 mg per kg of solumedrol per day. And if they don't reverse within the first few days, we then up the dose of steroids, often doubling the dose of steroids. And if they're not better by 7 days, we start thinking about giving infliximab. And generally, once they get to the point where we give them high-dose steroids, we taper over no less than around 30 days.
Any sense about whether or not this kind of episode and use of steroids, how it affects the anti-tumor activity?
Well, you know, the prevailing wisdom is that it doesn't. It probably doesn't in most patients, but there are some patients in which we've given steroids and we've seen a loss of response. But in most patients, once they're responding, they develop an autoimmune toxicity and you give them steroids, they don't lose their response because of the steroids.
I wanted to ask you also about the pneumonitis, and it's always, you know, tricky to try to tease things like this out. It, you know, comes up with mTOR inhibitors. You know, how do you monitor people? What do you do? So first of all, in terms of the pneumonitis, do you just look for symptomatology or do you do any kind of screening imaging?
Mostly look for symptomatology. So anybody who comes in with an increased cough, a little bit of shortness of breath on exertion, and if they have anything that's concerning in the clinic, either by physical exam or history, we actually walk them up and down the hall and look to see if their O2 saturation goes down. And if it does, we'll either get a chest x-ray. If we're concerned, we'll get a non-contrast chest CT and look for evidence of pneumonitis. That's primarily with anti-PD-1. We don't see it that often with ipilimumab. Actually, you almost never see it with ipilimumab.
Any unusual problems you've seen with ipilimumab? Again, it's out there in practice. Any subtle problems that maybe people miss, for example, endocrinopathies?
Well, sure. Endocrinopathies are one of the things that people most commonly miss because people present with more fatigue or a little bit of, usually their spouse comes in and says they're a little bit confused and they're not feeling well. Usually they have minor laboratory abnormalities, sodium's a little bit down, potassium's a little bit up, but not always associated with lab abnormalities. But the characteristics of hypophysitis, primarily hypophysitis, is so clear. I mean, you can almost make the diagnosis over the phone.
What do they tell you?
Well, the 3-to-4-day history of feeling fatigued and weak, not being able to concentrate well, losing their appetite, they just feel terrible. And you can almost tell over the phone that it's not an infection, it's probably hypophysitis. We bring them in, we draw cortisol level, it's usually very low. You put them on 10 of prednisone, and within an hour or two, they start feeling better.
What about hypothyroidism?
So that doesn't present as acutely, and so we monitor for free T4 and TSH in the clinic with almost every dose, and we see the TSH go up. We look at the free T4. We start them on Synthroid. It's almost never a problem. I mean, never a clinical problem because we catch it and treat it early. Some patients will develop adrenalitis, which presents with very similar to hypophysitis because they have low cortisol levels. And there are things that we don't look for that the endocrinologists look for, like low testosterone levels, So we often refer patients who develop endocrinopathies to an endocrinologist for follow-up.
Another issue, you mentioned before the concept, I think you were talking about PD-1, but I don't know, this may apply to IPI also, of people who initially, quote, progress and then respond. And sometimes you hear people talking about, quote, pseudo-progression. What's this phenomena?
Well, unquestionably, in patients who receive ipilimumab, when you do their scans at 12 weeks, a subset of patients will either show clear progression, meaning new lesions or growth of pre-existing lesions. Some of those patients, not all, a subset of those patients, if you wait 6 or 8 weeks and you repeat the scans, you'll see that their tumors are starting to regress. So the new lesions may stabilize or start to regress. The ones that were growing before may start to shrink. It's an amazing phenomenon, but it happens. And we've shown pictures of patients who have multiple new liver lesions at week 12, and then we look at them at week 18, and those liver lesions start to shrink, and then eventually they all disappear. Now, whether that's real tumor progression or pseudo-progression, which means that the tumor is there, but it's just infiltrated by lymphocytes and it's all inflammation, we don't know which of those it is when we see them with progression at week 12.
I guess I'm not sure which drug I'm thinking about, but I thought I remember hearing about biopsies that had been done of these growing masses that look more like inflammatory.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes you'll do a biopsy of one of these lesions and it's full of lymphocytes and very few tumor cells. Let me just make a point about ipilimumab because it's a unique agent. Maybe it's true of other anti-cancer agents also. You don't always see complete concordance in regression for all the lesions. So we've had patients who've had enormous benefit, who have had 90% of their tumors regress, and one lesion that just continues to grow, and it doesn't shrink. And then we resect it or treat it with radiation. And by doing that, and sometimes it's more than one lesion, one or two lesions that we have to treat with local means, we still get long, durable, progression-free survival. And that explains to some degree this discordance between the survival effect and the progression-free survival effect. I mean, there's almost no progression-free survival effect or very little effect with ipilimumab, but there's a real survival effect. And a lot of the patients that are out on that curve, not a lot, but a few of the patients that are out on that tail of the curve, which can extend out to 10 years, some of those might not even have been classified as objective responders.
One other thing I want to ask you about before we talk about your cases, and I want to ask you about adjuvant therapy too, but I don't know if this is the paper you're referring to, but I see that you had a case report of ipilimumab-induced perforating colitis, 3 patients with perforating colitis. What happened with these patients, and what's the message?
There are patients who will develop colon perforations without any pre-existing symptoms. So they might just present with a perforation. So you have to be on the lookout for somebody who comes in with fever and abdominal pain and think about the possibility that they've perforated a viscus. And this is a life-threatening complication. You have to take them to the OR usually or put in a drain, get the surgeons involved right away.
So no diarrhea, nothing. They just come in with perforation.
That can happen, but that's the really rare case. The vast majority of perforations occur in patients who have ongoing, you know, diarrhea or colitis. And I think if you look at the data, that this early intervention of treating patients with high-dose steroids has probably reduced the incidence of bowel perforations. I mean, in our experience here at Yale, the two that I remember, one was a woman who very early on in our experience, when we were just learning how to give the drug, we did treat her with steroids. We tapered the steroids, but she had ongoing symptoms. She underrepresented those symptoms to us, and we didn't really know to act on it. And after a number of months, she developed a bowel perforation. She survived, but ultimately succumbed to her disease. The second patient actually came in with C. diff colitis, and we treated him for C. diff colitis, and we gave him steroids. But despite what I think was appropriate treatment in that case, he developed a perforation and went to the operating room and unfortunately lost his bowel. He had very severe colitis.
I'm curious in terms of immunotherapy in the adjuvant setting. I've heard it argued both ways over the years. Theoretically, should it work better or not as well as in metastatic disease?
That's a really hard question. I would say that there's a possibility that they would be more effective in the adjuvant setting. However, there is a lot more toxicity when we start using these combinations, and whether you would expose patients to this kind of toxicity if they have a reasonable chance of having long, durable, possibly even cures in the adjuvant setting, I don't know. I think what we really need are better biomarkers in the adjuvant setting to tell us who's really going to relapse and who's not. Because if you treat an unselected population, I think a lot of people would find this kind of toxicity unacceptable in the adjuvant setting. Maybe what we need to do is treat patients with stage 3C with this combination, and the ones with 3A and 3B disease, we wait until they recur. There may be a point in time, however, even if we don't have predictive biomarkers, if we get really very good at treating metastatic disease, if we don't have predictive biomarkers, we ought to wait until they have metastatic disease. There's no point in exposing patients to potentially life-threatening toxicities if they're going to be cured, if you can rescue them at the time that they develop metastatic disease.
There's one other question I was going to ask you earlier. Just from a global point of view, if you look at melanoma in terms of the kind of mutational change, when you started out talking about the whole model of immunotherapy, you were talking about tumor mutations. What's the spectrum of mutations that are seen? I don't know if there's the whole genome project look at this. I kind of have this view of melanoma become almost like lung cancer, you know, external carcinogen that just creates havoc all through the genome. Is that your concept?
That's exactly correct. I mean, if you look at the number of mutations by malignancies, melanoma is at the very top and lung cancer is very high. That's not the only explanation for why people respond to immune therapy. You can have a low number of mutations, but if you have the right mutation, you'll be responsive to immune therapies. There was actually a recent paper from the surgery branch, and I believe it was in Science Translational Medicine, of a patient with a hepatobiliary tumor. Again, not a lot of mutations, but one critical mutation, and if you generate the right T cells against that mutation, you can get very significant tumor regression. We also see responses in patients with mucosal melanomas, for example, and they have a lower number of mutations. And immune therapy is active in renal cancer, which has a lower, relatively lower number of mutations. So it doesn't explain all of the activity that we're seeing, although probably the more mutations you have, the more likely you are to respond to immune therapy.
Although, you know, then I'm thinking about the whole concept of targeted therapy and driver mutations, but what you're saying is like a completely different model.
So several of my colleagues have raised this notion. If you have one or two driver mutations and not a lot of other abnormalities in the genome, perhaps those tumors are the ones that are best treated with targeted therapies because there's not a lot of ways to escape the block of that significant driver mutation. But once you start getting up to many, many mutations, there's probably lots of ways to escape a single targeted agent. So maybe the way we ought to look at this is the more mutations you have, the more you should focus on treating those patients with immune therapies. If you have single driver mutations like CML and not a lot of other problems in the genome, those you hit with targeted therapies. That's not to say that I don't think we ought to be treating patients with a small number of mutations with immune therapies. Maybe we should be, but that's a paradigm for the future.
Is that, I think I've heard somebody say that you see better responses to checkpoint inhibitors and lung cancer in smokers?
There's a little bit of data to suggest that that's the case, yes.
And that sort of goes along with what you're saying, though, because you think the smokers have more genomic damage.
That's right. More opportunities, more mutations, more chances to generate T-cell responses. But I think because a group of patients has a lower, relatively lower number of mutations, again, does not mean that they won't be responsive to immune therapies. We may just need to work harder in those patients. They may have the right T cells, but we need to work harder at expanding those T cells. Maybe in those patients, we need to identify those T cells, take them out of the body, expand them, and give them back. Because even in those patients with relatively lower number of mutations, they may not still be ultimately responsive or cured with targeted therapies, for example.
So what you were just saying kind of reminds me of the chimeric antigen receptor T cell strategy. Do you see, like, in the future that you're going to choose different directions, or you think combining them? And could you see given CAR T and a checkpoint inhibitor?
Absolutely. I mean, even if you give a bunch of T cells to a patient, they still have to get into the tumor microenvironment. Even if these are all antigen specific, even if they're all activated, once they get into the tumor microenvironment, their activity could well be blunted by checkpoints. So I think one of the most exciting trials out there, actually, I believe it's going to be done at MD Anderson, is a trial of TIL therapy in combination with anti-PD-1.